So I just want to remind you where we left off the last time. We were talking about two-parameter scaling. And so we considered that the possibility that the singular part of the free energy might obey the following scaling relation, that these, if you scale the temperature variable by some factor, and you scale the magnetic field by some factor, then the whole free energy would be multiplied by this factor. And we then were able to show that if the free energy, the singular part of the free energy, obeys this kind of scaling relation, then it must have the form, or it can be written by then Fs can be written as or has the form Fs of tau and h is, and we wrote it this way, tau to the 2 minus alpha times some function of h over tau to the delta. Where delta is equal to yh over yt. And 2 minus alpha, how do we say it? 2 minus alpha is d over yt. Okay, so that's where we left off, just to remind you, recap. And I think it was not, I think the derivation of that was moderately convincing. Okay, so one thing that you can see from this, so basically this tells you how the free energy depends on temperature and field in terms of these exponents and this unknown scaling function. And you notice that there's only two exponents that enter into this. But if you know the free energy as a function of temperature and field, then you can calculate those four exponents that you calculated yesterday in the tutorial, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. So that immediately suggests that alpha, beta, gamma, and delta are somehow can be, are not totally independent. Okay? It's like there's four, I mean, experimentally, you measure each of them. You can really measure each one of those. But in this theory, they would just come out of something simpler. So let's look at how that works then. So basically what I'm saying is that alpha, beta, gamma, and delta Okay, now when I say by extension, we'll get to that. Let's just talk about alpha, beta, gamma, delta. Okay. So for example then, the magnetization is M, which is dF dH. And so in terms of this function, the singular part of the magnetization, which is it's all singular coming, you know, as you go down to TC and then lower, it's behaving in this singular way. So this would be something like tau to the 2 minus alpha minus delta times g prime of h over tau to the delta. Just differentiating brings out a tau to the minus delta. Okay? And so if you consider so if you consider zero field, where you know that, then this says that where beta then is 2 minus alpha minus delta. So that tells you how to express beta in terms of these exponents, alpha and delta. So now, next, consider the how the magnetization varies when little, when tau is zero and you vary h. Okay, this is when h is zero and you're varying tau. Okay, so we know that this goes like h to the, sorry, 1 over delta. 1 over that curly delta, or small delta. Now, what that tells you is that g prime of h must look like h to the 1 over delta, okay? But h to the 1 over, h carries with it this factor of tau. So we've already said it goes like tau to the beta. And then I'm telling you then, in order for this to happen, because h only appears here, then this must go like h to the 1 over delta, but that immediately brings along a tau to the, very nice notation, delta over delta. Okay? So now, and this is as for tau zero, in order for that to work, these two guys have to cancel out, leaving you with the magnetization that goes like h to the 1 over delta. So that means that beta is equal to delta over little delta. And so basically then, M has this form. Okay. So writing it in terms of experimentally observable, measurable parameters. So now, how can we utilize this information? Okay, so now I'd like to show you see if I can get this to work. What do we want here? We want a screen, and we want lights low. Ah, it's looking good so far. We have to have faith here. Wow, okay, good. So let's go on. So here are some data, not very new data. Fortunately, the magnetization of a ferromagnet is not so hard to measure. Wasn't so hard. Well, of course, these guys were really brilliant back in 1926. They could still measure amazing things. And so what I guess Weiss and Forer have done here, Forer, is measured the magnetization as a function of field at many different temperatures that are close to the critical temperature. And you can sort of see here that for high temperatures, the magnetization starts off linearly. And for low temperatures, it starts off at a non-zero value in zero magnetic field. Yes? This, Oersteds? Oersteds, O-E. It's not a, what do they call the units these days? Standard, SI, it's not an SI unit. Okay. Also, I think one Oersted is one Gauss, actually. But Gauss is also not an SI unit. Actually, a much more interesting question, Andre, is what are the units on the vertical axis? Yeah, okay. That's a very interesting one because it confuses everyone. So what it's saying is, I think, actually I can't quite read it. It's saying electromagnetic units per, it's either gram or mole, I'm not sure. It looks more like gram. Gram, yeah, it's electromagnetic units. But electromagnetic units are units of magnetization, in this case, per unit mass, apparently. Okay, just don't worry too much about that. It's very rare that you actually have to convert amongst these units of mass. I actually ran into this once where I wrote to some guy at the Royal Society in London about exactly how this units should be expressed, and got back some somewhat ambivalent answer. Ambiguous, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, so let's not get into that. Let's just assume that they've actually. So, I mean, what it means in some sense is that they've calibrated the magnetization that they measure, probably in terms of some kind of force or torque on the sample and having weighed the sample. Okay. But I think really for our purposes, the fact that it's linear at the higher temperature and starts off at a non-zero value and goes up at a lower temperature is really the key. And also it's important that this temperature range is actually a rather small fraction of TC. So TC is some number in the middle there that we'll see in a second. And the fractional range of T minus TC over TC is not large. Okay. So that's a lot of data. And so the question is, how can you make use of this scaling form? Well, the way you make use of it is like this. Okay? So basically, what's presented here is the magnetization divided by tau to the beta. Okay? So that's on the vertical axis. And on the horizontal axis, it's the magnetization is being plotted versus this scaled variable, H over T minus TC to the beta delta. Okay? And so then all of the dots, not all of the dots, but there's at least four different temperatures in the various symbols that lie along this line, where this line down here comes from all of the data where T is above TC, and the line on the top comes from all of the data for which T is less than TC. Okay? Yes? Yeah, so that's the trick, right? If you have the wrong beta, or the wrong delta, or the wrong TC, then these dots will be all over the place. But when you figure out, or maybe you knew in advance or something like that, what the right betas and deltas are for this system, and you determine TC very accurately, then everything, this is called data collapse, collapses onto these two very nice lines. Okay. This is actually a homework problem in Huang's book, but I thought it was so important to just present it, where they give you a table of the data and tell you to plot it this way and so forth. I mean, it's certainly when you do that, you appreciate more the fact that it didn't have to be this way, especially if you weren't given beta, delta, and TC to start with. Okay. So this is a remarkable observation that this physical system, nickel, ferromagnetic nickel, actually follows this scaling form. And this scaling form presumably comes from some deep underlying physics, which we haven't really explained yet completely. I mean, well, we've hinted at, yeah. Well, okay, I guess, yeah, okay, I don't know. You'd have to go back and look at the table of data. So there must be a plus symbol corresponding to some data above TC. And so probably, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's what he's saying. And it could be that they correspond to different temperatures, but a plus can be used for a set of data below TC and also for another set of data above TC, I think. To be honest, we can pull out the data table and you can look and see. I mean, there were clearly more temperatures on that previous plot. More than four. So he's only using four symbols. So I guess he's dividing them into, T is greater than TC and T less than TC. I'm pretty sure. But like I said, this we'll probably even we should probably even post this on the wiki, the whole table from Huang. Okay, so let's leave this up because there's one more thing that I want to show you. But before we go there, let me turn the lights back up. Good. Yeah. Right. Correct.
So if I look at that formula for n, can you see that the negative tau and the positive tau should both be the same m, which is the absolute value of it?
Aha.
But here on the plot,
they're different. Right. Okay. So that's an interesting thing. So basically, when you derive this, you're basically saying that the magnetization has to be of this form, okay? And you can base that on what happens above TC, and you can base it on what happens below TC, okay? In either case, as you approach TC, you have this diverging correlation. As you TC and H equals zero, you have this diverging correlation length, okay? But what we really haven't put into this is that it should be the same function, or for that matter, the same exponents above and below TC. Okay, because TC is clearly a very non-analytic point, and you can imagine that you have two functions and two exponents, two betas, two deltas, and so forth. Okay, and so what this graph is telling you, what these data are telling you, is that, yes, there is a G plus and a G minus, but the exponents are the same. Okay? So that's the truth. That's what the data say, and that's what a theory which actually describes the data should say. And so the question is, why? I'm trying to decide where to write. Let's write here. Are there more questions? Okay. Okay, so I'd like to say a little bit more about relations among the exponents. Okay, so we've said that M is tau to the beta times some function of H over tau to the beta delta. And now the susceptibility chi is dmdh. And so what's that? That's equal to tau to the beta minus beta delta times G prime of H over tau to the beta delta. And we know that chi of tau at H equals zero, then, well, we infer from this that that's equal to tau to the beta times 1 minus delta And by the definition of the susceptibility exponent gamma, that should equal tau to the minus gamma. Okay. So what that tells you is that gamma equals beta times delta minus 1. Okay, since we have... So also, we earlier showed that that beta is 2 minus alpha minus delta, which is equal to 2 minus alpha minus beta delta, because this delta is that. And then if we use this, that beta delta there is gamma plus beta. From above. So therefore, you can write this out as alpha plus 2 beta plus gamma is 2. Okay, so I mean, that's sort of nice because I've told you that these alphas, betas, and gammas, it's not like they're integers or rational numbers, even they're just numbers. But they add up to 2. Okay? This this identity was derived by Rushbrook. I don't actually have the reference. And actually, this one here is due to Ben Whittam. Who was a colleague of Michael Fisher's at Cornell in chemistry. Yes. Yeah, so. Yeah, this has a prime, sorry. I think that's right, yeah. Sorry, here. Yeah, I guess this is prime. Okay, so where does that get us? Double prime, right. Okay, so that's not going to change anything though, right? I'll fix it, but that's front. So this was prime. And this is double prime. But still same exponent, right? Yeah. Okay, good. Just to keep these things together, you'll recall that we earlier derived that chi goes like c to the 2 minus eta, which implies that gamma is nu times 2 minus eta. And this was actually derived by Michael Fisher. Okay, so we have this. That and this. And so for the six exponents, alpha, beta, gamma, eta, and nu and eta, we now have three relations among them. Okay, so that at best there's three independent parameters. There, in fact, will be only two when we sort of go to the last step of this argument. But let's just look at this for a minute. So this is a table from Huang's book where he lists values of the exponents at some point in time, gathering together both experimental and theoretical results. Okay, so the point about these exponents, alpha, beta, gamma, eta, nu, is that they're all things that you can measure. Okay, so even though they may not be independent in some theory, they are. It's a different experiment to measure each one of them. Okay, so. So there's real information there when you say what the experimental values of these constants are. And now, I'm not sure. I assume that when he says experiment, he means experiment for physical systems that fall in the 3D icing universality class, like liquid gas and binary mixtures and various things. Okay. Because, of course, there's, as you can see here, so on the right here, he's shown certain models. There's mean field theory, and I think we've calculated all of those. There's the two-dimensional icing model, which Onsager and people who followed in his footsteps have calculated for us. There's the 3D icing model, which is a little bit harder to get the exponents, but you can by numerical simulations, you can do it to high accuracy. There's the epsilon expansion and sort of extrapolations based on the epsilon expansion. And then this is the 3D Heisenberg model, I assume. He doesn't have the 3D XY model, but anyway. Okay. So the point is that the exponents can be different in different dimensions. They seem to depend, if you just look at the icing model, they clearly are different in different dimensions. And also, what the last column shows is that for models in the same dimension, but with different symmetry, the exponents can be different. Okay, so the icing model still has this spins, this discrete up-down symmetry, whereas the Heisenberg model, the spins can point in any direction on the sphere, on the unit sphere. So that seems to be something which affects the values of the exponents. Okay. But what I'd really like to call your attention to is this first is this comparison here of these combinations of exponents, which basically, for instance, you have this rule, which says that if you add up these exponents in the right way, you just get 2. Okay? And that's based on the scaling hypothesis. So when you do that, just taking experimental data and get a number like 2, then that's telling you experimentally or empirically that this kind of a relationship holds that's derived from that scaling hypothesis. So if you like, it's an experimental determination that something like that might be happening. Now, if you just had one of them, that would only take you so far, but these other ones, which should be 1, are also obeyed. So that's, I guess, the 3 scaling relations that we've written here just now. Yes? Yeah, I don't know. He doesn't have any data there. We have, that's the one, 2 minus alpha equals d nu. Yeah. He doesn't seem to have any data for that. I'm sure there is data for that. But this is, I think this is the hyperscaling one, which doesn't always hold. Yeah.
Dan.
Oh, here? Well, for the icing, 3D icing model, I would say these days there wouldn't be any error bars in those significant figures, if you see what I mean. And there are ways. I mean, so back in the olden days when computers were, you know, big things and you couldn't simulate very large systems, people like Michael Fisher developed what's called finite size scaling theories, where the simulator, the guy who was doing the numerical simulations, would simulate different sizes of systems and plot the results for different sizes. And interestingly enough, there's another scaling variable. This is something actually I wanted to say to you today. There's another, if you like, it's not really a thermodynamic variable, but in addition to tau and h, the system size, n, or if you like, 1 over n, if you have a finite size system, you don't have a critical point, right? Because it's a finite size. Once the correlation length gets to the size of the system, everything gets washed out. It's a little bit like if you put on a magnetic field, a little magnetic field, on your ferromagnetic system and then try to vary the temperature, that transition gets wiped out. So you can almost think of 1 over n as being another thermodynamic variable, except it's not thermodynamic. It's another variable. And when it's 0, it has to be 0 for you to have a real critical point. Okay. So now you can develop, in fact, we probably should be doing it in this course. We won't do it right now. But you can develop an extension of this scaling theory where you, in addition, take 1 over n. And of course, that's exactly what comes out of experiments. They do it for different values of 1 over n. And what the Monte Carlo people then want to do is they want to find the limit as n goes to infinity, or 1 over n goes to 0. And they can do that making use of the scaling properties, the fact that the only thing that really is mattering in this problem is how the correlation length is diverging. And the information that they get about how the functions behave as the correlation length approaches the system size for many different system sizes gives them enough information to extrapolate to n equals infinity. Okay, so there's a lot of analysis and theory of exactly the kind that we're doing. that goes into analyzing simulations, Monte Carlo simulations of the, say, 3D icing model and other models. Like I say, my guess is that the systems that they're comparing to each other here in that column are all icing-like in the sense that there's a one-component order parameter. Okay, I mean that's whereas like the Heisenberg model has a more components. Okay, so I think what. I think what he's, experimental values from a variety of systems. Yeah, so from a variety of systems is like the ones that I showed you that, so this is related to this concept of universality class, which is a class of systems which will all have the same exponents. Okay, and then typically one thinks of defining universality classes in terms of the dimensionality of the system, the nature of the order parameter and symmetry of the order parameter. Okay, so, but he's done everything. I'm sure that all those things are icing-like or one component.
That's why the icing-free.
Oh, that one. Yeah, that should be exact. This is, yeah, this one here. Yeah. I mean, I think that this, it's probably true that that combination of exponents that some errors cancel or something like that to give you high precision too, this sometimes happens. Okay, so, I mean, at this point, I just wanted to say something about who contributed to our knowledge. I mean, if you think that the, our knowledge of renormalization, running coupling constants, and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, these are sort of the foundations of modern theoretical physics. But there's a whole army of incredibly skilled, diligent, hardworking people who are experts at, were experts at measuring P, pressure, density, magnetization, and particularly temperature extremely accurately, who basically developed the evidence that systems of this type behave in this way, which are described by the scaling theory. Okay, and I think as you go on in your theoretical education, you'll see countless places where these concepts pop up, probably already in field theory. Okay, so, yeah, so that's it for experiment. Maybe, Sita, can you put the screen up? Okay, so the question is, why should this be? Okay, and so what I'd like to start out with is the sort of pretty intuitive idea of Leo Kadanoff, which are called referred to as Kadanoff length scaling. So now I have to draw a nice, try to draw a nice picture. Let me see what I can do here. Draw a lattice. Jeez, not doing enough here. Okay, so let's, I need more. So the idea here is that this is a lattice of spins. And what Kadanoff would say is, let's divide it up into blocks. Where are we going? Three. And so forth. That's a block. That's part of a block. Okay. So these are blocks whose dimensions, linear dimensions, are L. And there's a spin for every dot. So there's n spins Si. And what we want to do is we want to define a spin, a new kind of spin that's associated with every block. We'll call them mu I. And because there's many S spins per block, there's fewer block spins, and in fact there's n over L to the d block spins. Ui. And now we want to think of the situation where we're close to a critical point. And so the correlation length is long. In fact, consider C much larger than L. That's where we are. Okay. So in that situation, what you expect is that all the spins in a block are highly correlated, and you can almost think of them as a single spin. And that's what these block spins are. So, and so you can imagine, I guess, defining a block spin by saying that whatever the average of the spins in this block are, that determines the sign. Mu I is plus or minus one. But its sign is determined, say, by the average of the spins Si in a block. That'll always give you some result. That's called majority rule. It's a democratic way of assigning block spins. Okay. So now, just for notation, I'm going to define K beta j and H. Beta H, and the critical point is KH. Zero. Okay. So now the idea is the following, that, So the idea is the following, that we want to define new coupling constants. These are the coupling constants for the S's. We would like to define new coupling constants for the block spins mu in such a way that the form of the free energy, basically has the same value for the block spin system and the original system. Okay? It's not going to be exactly that. Okay? But I'll show you what I want to say. Okay, but first of all, So really what I want to do is define a K prime and an H prime I think what I said was probably premature. That's actually what we want to do. Let's assume that the correlation function of the Ising model the correlation length of the Ising model is some function of K and H. And we basically want to find the coupling constants K prime and H prime, which reduce the correlation length by a factor of L. Okay, so if you imagine that the correlations are dying off, you know, with some, how are the correlations dying off? The correlations are dying off something like that, with a length scale which is larger than a block. But in terms of the block spins, it's dying off at a much shorter distance. Okay. So that, in principle, is an ingredient in defining K and H prime, K prime and H prime. And so the free energy of the n-spin system should basically have two parts to it, one of which this is the part that comes from inside a block. There's going to be some free energy associated with the spins in a block, okay? But inside the block, basically the correlation length is already larger than the block size. So the intra-block, the internal free energy associated with the spins in a block, you would expect it to be analytic, because it's like a finite size system where the correlation length is larger. It would be some slowly varying function. But then, there's the free energy that's associated with the n over L to the d interacting block spins mu. So this comes from interactions between different blocks. And what's special here is the intuitive idea that this function f of k prime and h prime is the same function as the icing free energy for k and h. Okay, so that's a big conjecture, but that's putting in the physics that you can replace the icing spin problem by a block spin problem with different coupling constants, and then have the same correlation length in terms of where it takes you in your lattice, and have that the block spins should act like big icing spins. Well, they're not big because they just take on values plus or minus one, but everything gets absorbed into the coupling constants. Okay. So that's, and this part here, I mean, we know that this has a singular part, this free energy of the icing model, and this is the same function f, so it has a singular part. That's what you want to compare, is the singular parts of the left-hand side and the right-hand side of this equation. There is no singular part to this because of what I said. Correlation length is larger than the block size. Its internal free energy is analytic. Okay, let's put this. This is the middle one. So at this point, we wanted to refer everything to the critical point, and okay. So we're going to compare the singular parts to the left and the right there. And what we get then is fs t prime h prime equals l to the d fs and then c So it's just repeating the second equation and so what does this tell us? Actually, I guess this is just Okay, sorry. Now we want to make the scaling assumption. That t prime is l to the y sub t, t, and h prime is l to the y sub h, h. Okay, and then if that's if you write it that way, then fs of I mean, this is nothing new, except for the interpretation. Okay, the idea that that this free energy at the scale for the block spins is down by a factor of L to the D from the original spins, but has these new coupling constants, which we write in this way. Okay, so that's not, there's nothing too new there, like I say, except for the physical picture. However, there is something new under the sun. Which has to do with this interpretation of the correlation length, that C of y, L to the y sub t, L to the y sub h is equal to C of t and h over L. Okay, so that this block spin transformation reduces the correlation length by a factor of L. And in particular, this is like a one parameter scaling now. So we know that the result is power law. It's a simple power law. C of t and zero is, call it C naught t to the minus nu. And if you put that solution in here, on the left-hand side, we have, this is the middle. No, it's the front. Just bring it up a little bit. From here, we have C naught L to the minus Y sub T nu. T to the minus nu on the left, and on the right we have C naught L to the minus 1 T to the minus nu. These go away, these go away. And so basically, what the result is that yt nu is 1. Okay. So in this picture, the thermal exponent is 1 over nu, or if you like, nu is 1 over the thermal exponent. And that's because if you interpret this in terms of block spins with blocks of size L, the correlation length is reduced by one factor of L. Okay. So nu then is 1 over yt, which is, you may recall that we wrote the thermal exponent in terms of alpha as 2 minus alpha over d. Or so this can equally well be written as 2 minus alpha equals d nu. This is called the hyperscaling relation. this actual relationship between the exponents was due to Josephson. And Kadanoff's argument is basically motivates that. So so if you look at this, so this of all these scaling these relations among exponents that we've written down, this is the only one that actually depends on the dimensionality. Okay, and so let's just look for d equals 2. Ising, what do we know? Alpha 0 and nu is 1. Oh, and that's good. Yeah, right. Yeah. So nu is 1, d is 2, alpha 0, and you get 2. So that's all fine. Okay. And a an important question is mean field theory, when does it work and when doesn't it work? And that's actually what we're going to spend a lot of time talking about in the next lecture. Okay? But let's just look at mean field theory. For mean field theory, alpha 0. You all calculated that yesterday. So that little jump in the specific heat is interpreted as alpha equals 0, which can also, by the way, alpha equals 0 can equally well correspond to a log. Of course, you can always have log corrections in these things. And nu equals 1/2. So that tells us that that d is 4. Okay. So what does that mean? Well, we know our mean field theory really doesn't have the dimension in it. I mean, none of the mean field exponents have the dimension. And so what this is telling you is when is mean field theory right? And the answer is that it's right in d equals 4. And it's wrong in other dimensions, d equals 3, the ones that we know and love. Okay. So, so if you like, when you think about mean field theory, we know that if you're away from TC, and things are sort of varying smoothly, mean field theory does a reasonable job. And as you go towards TC, it breaks down if D is less than 4. And actually, it breaks down more as D gets smaller. So it's it breaks down in 3 dimensions, but it's much worse in 2 dimensions. Okay. So so actually, that's all I wanted to do today. It seemed like a good place to stop and pick up in a different vein on Monday.